Welcome to Manufacturing Insiders. Today I have Ethan Barron with me. This is going to be a fascinating talk. Ethan has developed what we like to call a factory in a box. I mean, this is an incredible piece of machinery that literally is what it sounds like. I mean, you can do everything from subtractive to additive to QC all inside of one station. Which I just think would be such a powerful tool for so many manufacturers to add to their businesses. And another super cool thing about Ethan is that he didn't take a traditional route. I mean, this wasn't like a, you know, college degree and a planned out program. He was passionate about 3D printing, about additive manufacturing, and just kind of used his experiences and learned as he went and came up with this system that there's some pretty big OEMs talking very positively about. So welcome to Manufacturing Insiders, Ethan.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Awesome. So before I get too far into it, just like to make a quick note, please subscribe to our channel. If you're watching this video, if you think these are interesting things to you, make sure you follow us and share us with coworkers and colleagues. We'd love to get more listeners in on these types of very interesting episodes. If you are a leader in manufacturing and you have insights and experience and knowledge that could benefit other leaders, go to manufacturinginsiders.com, fill out the form there, and we'd love to have you on as a guest. So Ethan, tell me how this product came to be. And I guess you have a couple different models, so I'll let you describe what they are.
Sure. Yeah. Ooh. It was the result of a very long R&D cycle. I mean, we're very privileged to have some notable developers on our team, folks that helped invent some of the most notable firmware, software, and even hardware platforms in all the 3D printing and similar related industries, which, you know, definitely gave us a bit of an edge starting out and leveraged a lot of things that I think other companies might not have. For example, our lead researcher developed one of the, it's the largest shell script tool chain in the entire world. And we've leveraged that to design, innovate, iterate, create software and other technologies that would have taken us far longer or entirely been out of reach. And really kept in mind.
What is that? Could you just define the shell script? I'm not familiar with that.
Sure. It is essentially a massive back-end tool chain to our R&D that's able to make the whole modeling process and many other things just substantially easier, faster, and also kind of lets us start to innovate and iterate in topologies, shapes, and structures that would otherwise be off limits. And okay. So in doing that, you know, design tech that used non-traditional manufacturable parts, and if we couldn't produce those parts, we started building our own proprietary systems to make them, and then eventually built the machine. And so we were on the hot pursuit of just make the biggest, best 3D printer at the time that we could. And when we stepped back, we realized it was quite a bit more. It's kind of led around the whole ethos of the company and the idea of all-in-one production, because the spec and hardware technology was there to run it. So we figured might as well. So,
yeah. And so that's a great description of kind of where you're at. How did you, what even brought you into this whole world? You know, how did you decide at some point that you wanted to have this fully integrated solution in a box?
Sure. So like I said, it was kind of spin out from the R&D after we were going through these processes and we were making formally impossible to design shapes or topologies and then turning them into reality by making machines that do them, and started building our own system using all those shapes and topologies. We started to realize it was different. I mean, a lot of machinery is very much one machine does a specific function, a specific set of materials, and based on your budget, usually there's a small set of OEMs you can buy that function a machine from. Usually it's one. So there's a little less direct competition. So in our R&D cycle, we're figuring that was because of hardware. That, okay, the reason why it's one machine does one function is because that's just the better and more sophisticated way to build machinery. And in doing that, we realized when we made our machine that we built a system that we're going to initially figure out what the niche was, and that's what we're going to focus on. But it was outperforming a lot of our systems. It was faster than high speed. It was higher temp than usual high temp. It was more precise than a precision, etc. Then it felt just wrong to make it and force it into just one category when we were doing each of the other ones better. So we figured, what if we started a pursuit of mixing multiple of them in the same box? And that kind of led to the idea of, you know, all-in-one production and multi-mediums between your additive, your subtractive, your pick and place and other things being in the same system. If the hardware is actually there to be able to run it, why not? And that's what kind of, it was a pivot. You know, again, idea was bigger, better 3D printers. And once we realized what we had, it was a pivot to, okay, this is, let's shift to the technology that I think the industry really needs.
Yeah. Yeah. So give me an example of like a very unusually complicated, you know, assembly or component that you could make on this that you, you know, that a manufacturer that's listening would be like, holy cow, they can do that inside of one machine. Like,
So I love the example because it's actually the one, if we're almost going off a little timeline from research and development to in market, we have a separate system that we're going to release. We're hoping around maybe 2028. We think it needs a little bit of perception. We need folks to get used to the idea of all-in-one production before we do. That was the first unit. And in testing it, we worked with the DoD prime, so I can't give too much explicit detail, but we made a self-healing robotic assembly for them. So kind of how it worked is one machine, to describe it, we autonomously switch between different production methods. So usually on a production line, you move from machine to machine. Instead, we move through just the end effector tool of that machine. So if we wanted 3D printing, for example, the process, we started by grabbing 3D printing and then laid down carbon fiber body of the drone. Then we switch from printing to milling. We grabbed the spindle. And then, you know, we had these big thick layers, so we smooth it out for aerodynamics. And we switch from milling to pick and place. We had loaded in some add-on hardware like your motors and other things that might not make sense for us to produce. And as we're building up the body of the drone, we would pick up and drop the motor into place. Mm-hmm. Now, a machine would switch again. We would grab two, like, cameras, for example, other sensing equipment to be able to see where that motor is placed exactly, and then measure and identify where the pins were to now not just only print it into place to avoid assembly, but we then, you know, actually did ink tracing to do the actual wiring. So we're dropping into things like the chips and our add-on hardware and actually connected them together. And did some interesting stuff. Like, we took what would be like an 8-inch flat circuit board if it was populated on a normal board and then pick and place machine, all that. We did a less than 3-inch cube because we started placing them as we were building up. We laid down this kind of nervous system, this material that would foam up when electrically charged. So if this thing would crack in use, it would foam up and fill in the hole and keep operating, which was interesting, kind of self-healing there.
Very interesting, yeah.
And this product was thought to be something that was not manufacturable for the next many years. We did it today because this was able to produce new topologies that would otherwise be off limits. And we did 4 drones in about 30 hours. Sorry, before these robotic assemblies, wasn't a drone, in less than 30 hours, and did them end to end, everything minus uploading the code and firmware. And the realization there was, okay, not only did we just do this end to end, but because we did the job of the whole, what otherwise be a separate production line with some new equipment and stations, we would have been about 20%-ish cheaper than if a mass production factory could have done it that same day, because it was lower cost of goods sold. It was less power to produce it. It was less waste material. There was no tooling because it was, you know, on-demand processes like printing and milling. It was jobbing processes. In addition to that, we were doing it in other topologies. Like, this was thought to be a 50-plus part assembly we did in one cohesive piece. You know, so we'll never be competitive for an offshore and something that's one and done, like a simple injection mold cup or something. But, you know, the more steps we're talking about making a final product, and the more we start to do in one machine, when that curve starts to flatten, if not actually get lower costs in the factory, that starts to get very interesting. And that was kind of the first test of, okay, we're onto something. Let's really run this idea forward.
That's incredible. So are you, are you selling these products to manufacturers today?
So we have a bit of a pipeline. I like to give the analogy of Amazon strategy a bit. So we have separate systems, separate sizes, and separate capabilities. Right now, we only have one that's public. So the one I described, we're hoping to release closer to 2028, because right now, again, the machinery users, I think, are very used to, again, one machine, one process, one software. Right. And a machine doing multiple steps like that is admittedly a bit of a jump, and we don't want to startle the market with that. I look at Amazon, for example. They had the back end for online retail, but everyone was used to in-person retail at the time, and it was a bit of a jump to do everything full online. And so instead of starting in many different markets, so for us, instead of starting in all these different production markets, focus on one, drive a lot of attention in it, show value, improve yourself in it, and then go from that one to two, two to three, three to four, kind of like Amazon started in books, then went to CDs, movies, etc., all using the same retail online model backend, doing the same thing but on a hardware level. So that's why, like, the first button you click on our website, yes, it shows that we're initially in a 3D printing market. That's our book market for this analogy. Mm-hmm. You know, we're really trying to show, instead of needing a separate large format versus fine detail versus high temp versus high speed versus, you know, certain materials like your carbon fibers or your metals or anything else, here is your one-stop shop that's doing all these separate functions, which it easily costs you into this, you know, millions to have all these separate techs in the same, instead of separate platforms in one. And then the first video we show is, hey, if you want to pull off a tool and throw on a different one, you can actually go into an entirely separate method of production. That can be something like the examples we show online are, yes, you can do like printing and milling in the same cell. And that would now put us in two separate markets, printing and cutting, and the same hardware is there to run it. And, you know, slowly get people used to one machine, merging a couple of these at the same time. So mm-hmm. then hopefully 2028, we can have enough understanding behind something that's doing 10, 15 plus production methods in one box as well. So
wow,
baby steps there, but you know, those lighter platforms are in market and out there right now.
Okay. Yeah. And I mean, you can almost see this system growing in size, you know, to the size of a traditional CNC machine, but it's literally doing everything. All the finishing, all the machining, all the additive, yep. all the assembly. Wow.
Man. Yeah, think like your CNC tool changer, except those tools, instead of being just like different end bits, are can also be entirely separate production methods because yep. that machine has the torque and all the other spec to run it. And that's kind of the beauty there. So made the platform that can do it all.
Wow. That's awesome. So what market are you going to go after? Would it be, you know, the machine shops that, you know, should add this to their, you know, equipment list, or what sort of businesses are you looking at?
So it's been interesting for us because there is still a level of this company that is earlier stage. And I think a lot of times folks are expecting, oh, we're specifically focusing on medical or the machine shop or anything else. And for us, what we did and how we drew a lot of demand we have is we started bringing this machine to trade shows. We told people, interact with it, you know, unplug it, feel it out, try to break it like you did your last machine, because at the time we weren't trying to do a guerrilla marketing or any kind of publicity stunt. We were just trying to test the waters, test the market, right. See where it fits. So we're showing people, here's all the materials, here's what I can do. And given that everyone else out in most of these machinery shows has someone reading every line of code, hoping it doesn't fail, and here's the no-name startup saying, yeah, beat it up, because we're just trying to get a lot of user test studies before even selling it, that those interactions turn into demand from a variety of industries, from anywhere from film entertainment to oil and gas to automotive to mining, that robotics, aeronautics, aerospace, all everything in between, because yeah. you know, all those industries use plastics, metals, ceramics, and everything else that our systems are starting to touch on. So we figured just hit most of them. So we have a very nice variety of demand. But I think the largest area that we've seen interest is actually one that's been off the table before. So with technology like 3D printing, I think a lot of people back in the day were really hoping it would have been your supply chain risk mitigation piece. I mean, look at pandemic, recession, supply chain crisis, geopolitical shifts, all things that have changed our supply or delayed it. Everyone's yeah. like, you know, I wish we had something that could have done it here and now. But the centralized supply model is so embedded that it's hard to, especially when you don't have just one machine making a full product. Even 3D printers, even if you just need that plastic bit, you don't know the weight, the accuracy, the tolerance of that part. You need separate QC equipment to do that. And our system, you know, we're starting to do some interesting stuff, like at even the Evo system, Mark, we're starting to measure a lot of the data it produces. So for example, we're testing how much material is posting in a part, how much is actually in a part, how fast it's supposed to move, how fast it actually moved in. That's good to tell you when to clean, when to lubricate, but it's also enough data along with some photographing to tell you, hey, if you made this part in Texas and you have a other machine in, you know, Albania, for example, if you produce that part, say we spec out the part in Texas and say, hey, if it's within 99% size, weight, whatever, it's a qualified piece. Being able to run that same machine script on an offshore machine and be able to qualify to the same spec is major. That's kind of the missing piece in on-demand production. And we've tried to factor it into these systems. And so a lot of our demand is now people trying to do supply chain risk mitigation, have an option to. So we'll see larger general manufacturers want a lot of these machines for parts. We'll see DoD entities wanting it for parts that might not be in production anymore, be lacking supply, and starting to see a bit of that interest in decentralized production, which is kind of cool, exciting. It's one of the areas I like to nerd out on a little bit.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So there's unlimited applications, and I feel like this gets us closer to what I've said to a lot of people, that I think the future of the consumer market isn't going to be going to Amazon to buy whatever sort of, you know, electronic device that you want to buy. Even if it's a cell phone, I think you're going to end up having a 3D printer at your home that is going to actually make these items. You're just going to basically buy the license for it, and it is going to make the items. Obviously we're a ways off from a phone, but I think it's possible. I mean, I think what you've created makes it a lot more possible.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say too much that far away from a phone. We have, I can't give too much away, but we're hoping, tentatively, looks like January 22nd, we'll be releasing some technology that might be able to do just about that entire device from one device. But yeah, that's as much as I'll tease on that front. But yes, I do agree. And I think the future of it's decentralized. I'm not sure if I entirely agree with it being in the home. I think there's only two real routes that can be a consumer tech, because this goes into what 3D printing was trying to promise people, saying it's, hey, it's your Star Trek replicator, material goes in, product comes out, put it anywhere. And I think unless one of two things happens, either one, if we have the CAD or design literacy to do that, what I mean by that is, for example, we have a paper printer, because anyone can imagine whatever document they want, they can type it out, they can make their PowerPoint, their Excel. We have the skill set and literacy to do that.
Right.
And we can't necessarily do that with products. Not everyone has that 3D modeling, CAD, or engineering skill to think of it, design it, and then click print. Mm-hmm. And that limits people to thinking of whatever they want to make and clicking print from an online file. Think of that in paper printing. How often are you just printing someone else's PowerPoint, someone else's design document? It's rare, and that shortens your market. So the flip side of that is then, okay, if that's not the option, how else do we get it there? So almost touching on a part really like Amazon, say the technology evolves to the point that you can make full end-to-end products from a single device. The things that we're pushing on, for example, say this technology proliferates, it becomes very affordable, and say there's a partner like Amazon that starts to standardize and say, hey, you can click on anything from our catalog, and if you have this machine and these materials, you can produce it from the click of a button. When it becomes that kind of facilitated retail, it might be. But I think the most realistic case is that this starts to be more a tool in the community or the local business. You know, manufacturing mm-hmm. the hands of the business communities and front lines that need it the most, instead of just necessarily a consumer tool. So I could see this in like a rural village or something, to not only make parts, to maintain that sovereignty of producing water, solar, internet connectivity for the infrastructure, and then on the off hours, let them use it for R&D and, you know, give them some actual production power. But yeah, I see it more as a business tool than consumer, for at least the immediate term.
Sure. No, that makes a lot of sense. I do see a lot of application. I mean, I know a lot of guys. In fact, my cousin just put a CNC machine in his garage. He has a full-time job as a machinist. But I see a lot of these guys that start a machine shop with one machine in their garage. And mm-hmm. I just think that this is such an awesome tool, where somebody could start a rather complex, vertically integrated business model with one single machine. I think there's going to be a lot of that for you.
Yeah, no, I'm proud of it. We actually have a customer example. We had someone buy and finance a machine at, a couple $100 a month, which made it pretty accessible. And they were able to, they used it on off hours to go from 0 to 1 of a product, go through his MVP, through all his prototypes, and actually get his first couple thousand of his product in the market. And then on the main time, while he was doing all that R&D, he was actually doing contract manufacturing, producing on-demand parts from other people, which, running it for, I think it was like 3 days or something, already paid off that month of finance. So he was able to have a viable business on during the day and then go through all his R&D to actually make his product and get in the market during the evening, which is a pretty fun story. And I hope that see more of that, because I think that makes hardware R&D so much more accessible compared to, what we see of software, where anyone can just go behind a computer if you're hungry, learn code and make something, and hopefully can see the same thing in physical products too.
Yeah, and like if it ever did get to your standard consumer having access to something like this, I almost think by that time you would have design software that could just you could just communicate with it and be like, I want it to kind of look like this thing. And then it's like, oh no, change, like you're basically just talking, it's creating a 3D model as you're talking to it.
Yeah, we have been playing around a little bit with the concept of kind of AI CAD design, where you're going through that and having it design it for you, which has been really interesting to explore and something that I'm hopeful really develops further and supports some folks.
Yeah, that would be amazing. Yeah, and I was curious about that. So, with traditional manufacturing, when you get a design, a model, it's I would imagine that when you use a model in your device, it's going to have a lot more information in it, obviously, than one that's just going to a machine shop and here's the dimensions of the part, whatever. How does the design process for your product work?
Sure. So for us, the way that we're trying to integrate this is basically into standard CAD. We wouldn't be changing the design of the products themselves. There probably will need to be some evolution from some of the providers of that to enable you to more easily design new topologies and things that might otherwise be off limits. But all our job and the software layer of our job is to be able to take that design and then translate into machine code for our machine to produce. And so initially, when it's only one industry, say it's just 3D printing, it's just slicing, that's easy. But what we're starting to roll out and integrate with this as we move from printing to say moving from additive subtractive, we're starting to integrate, okay, instead of having your separate slicing and CAM software to produce a machine code, here's something that can help you bridge that gap and do a bit of both. And there's intuitive ways to interact with it where you can highlight an area and then almost like brush stroke on to say, okay, you might want to mill here a bit. And there's a definite part of it's the hardest part of thing is just making the proper order of operations, so then you're not getting dirty specs or something into different areas in your part that you don't want them to be. But that's been a whole lot of our back end that we've been building out as we start to make some of those moves. So hopefully making it easy where it can still integrate to everyone's standard process.
Yeah. And I mean, that is an important part of bringing new technology into any established space is making it easy to adopt like that. And there's a lot of challenges when you bring a new product to market, obviously making it easy to plug into an existing operation, but then also from an OEM perspective, having them be open to the idea of a new process being used.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a slow adoption for a lot of things. You have to make it easy, you have to make it accessible. And that was the big part about what I was kind of mentioning a little earlier of the qualification is that, okay, if you've now made this part, make it easy for them to understand that that is fitting and it's competitive with what you would otherwise get.
So, have you thought about kind of that education process? How do you start to educate the engineers, the guys who are making the drawings, on these new technologies like yours? And allow them to add some open-ended nature to their specifications. So you know, they could use your product to do that.
Sure. Like I said, at its current state, it integrates fully in just with whatever your standard process is. The only difference is if you want to really leverage some of the new features is that, you know, you start to have to shift. It is a bit of a perspective shift. An engineering school teaches you, here's what you can design. Here's a software you can design on. Here are the few machines that can produce these shapes. It's not telling you what to make. It's teaching you how to make it. And this system offers new geometries. We can produce the old ones. We produce all those standard shapes and structures, which means they can use it today. But if you want to make new topologies or other shapes and structures, you have to start looking at new design softwares and things like that. So I'm given that we're the machine itself, that's going to be a little less of our ballpark. But you know, trying to make some of those right partnerships to hopefully start to drive that adoption, because there is major potential in being able to make parts that are, say, you know, 30% lighter but 50% stronger by using new shapes and structures that are, you know, non-conformant usually. So,
right.
But, you know, support of other companies in there doing that. And in the meantime, we just give them the abilities to do it as they need. And it's there if they want it, or it's just as capable and sometimes, or a lot of times actually, outperforming the standard machine if you want to use it as a replacement of that as well.
Wow. Yeah, it's very interesting. So as far as you go, what knowledge did you have to be able to bring to bring this into existence? You know, are you a coder? Are you an engineer? Like, what? How did you get here?
Sure, I was very hands on a lot of the 3D printings side. That was my whole business background. I ran initially a small online business that was doing refurbishing, so buying broken down printers when the OEMs wouldn't, when no one would at the time too. It was a great time because we were kind of first to market there. Gave me a lot of intimate experience inside these machines when they were broken, because I didn't buy the parts from the OEMs to fix them. I would make my own, add new functions, features, since I'm making my own anyway, redesigning it. And we would be selling something that outperformed a Sarah machine from the factory floor. So that made it, that gave full experience on the machine design, all the things around it, and, you know, progressive improvements, especially as the industry was building out and figuring out its foundation. And then from there, kind of led to more R&D proper of making these technologies and then starting to provide them and get them into the OEM's ecosystems to improve the base systems instead of just doing it for one-off products here and there. And so I have been intimately hands-on with a whole lot of different manufacturing machinery, making them, improving them, getting them out, mostly on the hardware side, less so the firmware software, though I do have a decent bit of experience in both. And so any area that I don't know the best, I'm definitely going to hire and bring in the right folks that are way better than I can be in those sectors too.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's very impressive. You just kind of learned as you went. And so when you started your repair business, I guess what made you feel qualified to do repair in the first place? How did you even get into that?
The nice thing about 3D printing is that everyone kind of got the same starting point. Unless you're with 3D Systems or Stratasys, which are the two that had the patents from like the 80s, unless you're with them, you basically wouldn't have industry experience. You all start at the same point. Mm-hmm. And with that, you know, experience is a measure of time. I just sunk a lot of time in it because I thought it was exciting. I always liked tinkering. I was already in a company prior that was doing qualification machinery for production lines. So I already had experience within it. A decent bit of kind of engineering background from my own experience in education as well. And, you know, it always led to the kind of natural curiousness of ripping these things apart, fixing them up. And so the first few printers that I had, you know, I broke, admittedly, but I had one that just worked and worked well. And that led me to ripping it apart, building it back together and going at it over and over and over and making it better until I saw, oh, well, here's a $200 3D printer online. I'm going to buy it. I think I know what's wrong with it. I spent about $50 in parts, bought some material to make my own parts. Now, for about 2 hours of my effort, both from quick design of a part, you know, some quick feature adds and repair the thing, it sold when I went to sell it for over $8,000.
Oh,
and
wow.
There was opportunity because, again, if the OEM wouldn't buy it back at the time, so it was the advent of the industry. It was the starting point. No one else would. So a lot of these machines were genuinely selling for pennies on a dollar and weren't that hard to fix, especially because, I'm sure some people aren't going to like me saying this, but the very expensive industrial grade machines were pretty much the same hardware as the really cheap ones. The consumer grade with just a fancier shell on the outside. And so those were just as easy to fix. And so very quickly went from that one to all these other types of machinery. So you had a proper little business going, and that that went well. It was, like I said, it was a fun experience to see all the new things and be in with all the hackers and innovators making the new techs, understanding why they're better, and then starting to contribute back myself. So
yeah, I mean that's interesting. I mean, obviously it comes naturally to you to problem solve and innovate, but I feel it's a characteristic that we need to somehow foster in more kids. And I'm just curious, like, what was your childhood like? How did you kind of develop those characteristics growing up?
So I'm definitely going to lend my parents a lot of credit, because I think at the time I might not have liked it as much being a kid, but I definitely see the value now on the other end of things. They always very much push both entrepreneurial spirit and curiosity. So for the entrepreneurial side, for example, they tell me, because even at that point, it's hard to remember now. They're saying ever since I was six, they said I pay for everything except clothes, food, and board games. At the time, you can't work a proper job, but they said, okay, if you do this around the house, if you go out here and help this person, that means X many pennies, and X many pennies is a Lego set. And that drew a lot of interest at the time, and really, I think, helped inspire that. And so as young as I remember, I was doing I was into the Legos on the other side, so, and it got to the point of extremity where I even had toy stores having me actually do their front display sets and things like that, which are pretty cool, making custom things. And there was always that kind of entrepreneurial drive, and that filtered into all my interests because of that upbringing. And I think that front helped really push me forward in a lot of industries, especially earlier ahead before I think anyone was doing that in terms of age. And then on the flip side of that, in terms of the curiosity, the example I like to give is that they never even let me touch video games until I was in my teens. I could touch them, I could play some at friends' houses, but never, on my own at home. They're very much hands-on. It wasn't like, let's plug our kid into a screen instead of really being hands-on parenting them. And I'm sure it took a lot more effort on their front, but, even when I hit that age, they saved up and they said, hey, instead of, learn it, or instead of just playing the games, we're going to send you a camp to learn how to not just code them, but also make them. And there's a ton of examples of things that they've done like that, where it was different museum trips, it was traveling around the world, it was all sorts of different experiences that I very much appreciate that really grew my perspective and that natural curiosity to tear things apart, build them up, kind of hackerish. And it led to having a lot of that skill set, I think, earlier than most, which was a little jarring, especially given who your peers are at those ages and at that time, because you're doing all these things that are so disconnected, it's hard to fit in a bit. But not fitting in is, I think, the more popular side nowadays. So
I mean, it's certainly a lot of people that are successful didn't necessarily fit in with the other kids. And it's unfortunate that today fitting in with the other kids means that you spend a ridiculous amount of time, playing video games and doing a lot of really worthless things. And so I think that's great. I mean, I honestly am in the same boat. I was not allowed to play video games growing up, and we actually didn't even have a TV in my house until I was 16. So, because you're just outsourcing parenting at that point where you're sitting your kid in front of a video game or TV. And it does take a lot more work. I have two kids of my own now, and it's just everything you can do to keep them away from the TV, because it's so addictive. And if you get them addicted to that, then they aren't going to get the the dopamine from solving a problem and actually fixing something or actually learning something.
And if I had just that, I think, constant stimulation, I wouldn't have been literally ripping the panel off a PC and I'm starting to learn how every single part of it worked and opening books and reading them on the side to figure it out. I mean, that kind of, you need, in my opinion, I think you need a little bit of that boredom, or just, it's not even boredom, it's just a lack of constant stimulation to drive a lot of that curiosity.
Exactly. Yeah, you're absolutely right. No, that's an excellent point. So what opportunities are you looking for right now? Are you looking for investors? Are you looking for customers in a specific niche? Sure. What are you looking for?
So right now, we're definitely in a growth stage. We initially set ourselves up because these systems, again, are reliant on some parts that are not traditionally manufacturable. There's a good part of our manufacturing that needs to be in-house. And you don't go from years R&D to thousands a month. You do a couple. You break even. You test the waters and get your first few out there, which is kind of the state that we're in right now. But we have received demand from certain clients that far exceed current output because of that ability for on-site, on-demand, end-use parts. And so we're moving next year. We're going to large facilities and going through some growth stages there before taking on some larger orders. But in the meantime, we are taking on some smaller orders. So there is interested in that all-in-one printing capabilities between the polymers to the composites to the metals and everything else into one box. We're happy to provide for that. And going into next year, there's definitely going to be some fun press, interesting new technologies released, and we'll be at the capacity to take on some of these larger players. And so there's a little bit of investment that we're raising that's involved in it all too. So always happy to have conversation on that front too. But yeah, just trying to push technology that's really going to help change where and how a lot of manufacturing is done.
So. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it seems like the future. This seems like a great, just a really great space to be in. I mean, I've been preaching 3D printing additive manufacturing. So I think when you're kind of on the cutting edge of that cutting edge technology, yeah, it's going to be pretty exciting to see what happens in the next couple of years for you here.
Thank you. No, looking forward to it as well. It's been a fun journey so far, and it's a new kind of chapter. It's not the crazy R&D make it happen. Now it's scale, and I'm excited for that.
Very cool. Well, hey, thanks a lot for coming on today, Ethan, sharing. I'm sure that this is going to be curiosity provoking for a lot of listeners, and we'll be sure to include some contact information for you in the bio. But thanks for coming on today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.